One spring day last year, David Ewing was perusing eBay, a frequent pastime of his, and he came across something he had never seen before.
A poker chip from the 1890s was $5. It's really the size of almost a dime.
For reference, that's about $135 in today's money. This poker chip intrigued David because it came from the Climax Saloon. It was a business in a rather notorious part of downtown Nashville called Printer's Alley. David says there were a lot of poker chips going around at the time.
Nashville post-Civil War, a lot of the entertainment was gambling and drinking. These businesses tried to operate a normal business on the first floor, but then the upper floors is where the gambling and the prostitution and the drinking went on, and they were raided by police.
David Ewing knows a lot about Nashville history, like a lot. But what gets him really excited are these things that he finds, visual proof that something happened, whether it was monumental and dignified or mundane and a little seedy.
When you tell history, people obviously like the narrative and the storytelling, but the visual of seeing a 19th century poker chip, most people have never seen that before.
Today, we're interviewing three people who are bringing history alive in very different ways. David Ewing has one of the largest private collections of Nashville memorabilia. He collects items from the Centennial Exposition in 1896 and the women's suffrage movement and civil rights. Bradley Hansen is a folklorist, currently with the Tennessee Arts Commission. He documents the stories of people living in rural communities of Tennessee about their music and art.
I don't worry that much about people lying to me. I like that. I think that's the performance of history, the performance of memory.
And Jennifer Justice writes about food, Southern food in particular, how the meals we're eating today relate to the past.
Food is a lens through which to talk about the harder stuff of race and religion, and it doesn't necessarily make the conversation easier, but it at least makes the conversation maybe happen.
From Nashville Public Radio, this is Movers and Thinkers, where we introduce you to some of the most interesting people in the city. I'm your host, Emily Siner. I interviewed these guardians of the past, as I call them, together in front of a live audience in April.
This episode of Movers and Thinkers is sponsored by Strategic Hospitality, the creators of nationally recognized restaurants like Pinewood Social, LaSalle, and Catbird Seat. They believe Nashville is full of great stories, whether they're told as podcasts or over drinks. StrategicHospitalityOnline.com. And by Case Antiques Auctions and Appraisals. They auction real pieces of history, beautiful old things you can see and touch, like a 12th century Chinese bowl or a Confederate revolver. Browse and bid online at CaseAntiques.com.
So David is all about things. Bradley is all about people. People who are still alive and can actually tell their stories. Like this one guy he interviewed named Wade Hill. Wade was a banjo prodigy in East Tennessee. He started playing as a young teenager in the 1970s.
His mother was a drama teacher who pushed him to be a very elaborate performer. She dressed him up as a kind of Liberace. This is in East Tennessee in the early 70s in bluegrass. And that was his career for a while. And then he became a very serious musician and played with all sorts of very fine professional bluegrass bands as a sideman, as a member of their band.
Which sounds like a glamorous life. But in the very first hour that Bradley sat down with him, Wade started talking about how he was just really lonely.
Hear that? Dead silence, yeah. As opposed to 50 people in there and a big hoot and nanny, you know, it gets a little. A little melancholy, I guess.
So, can you explain the backstory to that?
Well, over the last few years, many of his family members, his parents have died, his common-law wife has died. And he recently lost the house that he lived in for 50 years and has been going through a very difficult time. And it turned out that he was willing to tell this incredible story about his life on the road, his childhood of being, you know, really pushed by his parents, his drug abuse, his rock and roll lifestyle.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, yeah. I'm not promoting that or anything, and I've since quit all that and try to live a good a Christian life as I possibly can. I still slip every now and then, but I mean, no. I had a rip-roaring time. There's nothing better than being on a stage in front of 10,000 people with a good buzz and them screaming at you and going on and stuff. Well, that's ecstasy.
I mean, he like goes into some pretty gritty stuff in this clip.
Yeah, that's who he is. When I approached him to do this project, we were very upfront. You know, this has to be how we are just sitting here talking. Are you willing to talk about all this stuff? And he was.
But with other people who are not so open, how do you decide when to ask those sort of difficult questions and what's the response that you get?
Wade is exceptional in that regard, in his willingness to talk about those things. I don't know that you can really ask them maybe the first time you interview someone, but I've been lucky in my research to interview people continually. They'll say, well, you've interviewed me before. What could we possibly talk about again? And just say, let's start from the very same spot. Go again. And all kinds of new things will come, and hopefully a little bit more openness each time.
I want to manufacture a little conflict here. Which is the better way to learn about history, through an object that is from the past or a story from someone who's still living?
Well, I don't think they have to be or can be separated.
Come on.
If you haven't, you know, in my work, I tend to think that I more collect memories than history. An object becomes a prompt for a story. If you had an object that was unrecognizable and no one left to tell a story about it, it would be basically useless.
I'll take the bait. It's always the object. You know.
Thank you.
I learned in law school the best evidence is actually the evidence from the period of time. And I'll give you an example. Lyft, the ride-sharing program, is moving to downtown Nashville, some of their back-office jobs. And the press release that went out said that they're moving in a building called the Nashville Sash and Door Building, which it was later. But when that building was built, it was a buggy company. So isn't that interesting? And the reason I know it was a buggy company, because I have the original advertisement and I have some stationery from that buggy company from the 1890s.
Well, and I would say if you have an old recipe that you recreate in real time with using all of the senses, so maybe you have an old recipe that involves meat that you put on a skillet and you can hear it sizzle and you can touch it to see if it's done. So you've got the document, but you also have the experience.
I'm glad that Jennifer got in the fight, because food is an immensely satisfying way to learn about history. Her latest cookbook, called Nashville Eats, basically has a mini history lesson that goes with each recipe. And most of them look really good. But there are a handful of recipes in there that are somewhat outdated and hard to make and make well. What's the point of having recipes that you are outdated?
Well, I wanted to do three things. I wanted to have the recipes that, you know, we had to have as a Nashville cookbook, hot chicken, meat and threes, that kind of thing. Then I also wanted to have recipes that aren't necessarily about Nashville, but that we love here, pimento cheese, deviled eggs, that kind of thing. But then I had to have the recipes that were more old-fashioned, like beaten biscuits. They started back in before commercial leavening, so in the 1800s, and so you would have to actually beat the dough to make it blister to create pockets of air. So instead of a regular biscuit like we might think of, like a big fluffy biscuit, it was more like a little wafer, more of a pastry type thing. Then along came a beaten biscuit machine, which is also really old-fashioned, and it requires these rollers, and it's time-consuming. So I had to sort of bridge from the past to the present with the recipe that you could make at home, but then I paired it with a story about Biscuit Love and Carl Worley.
Carl Worley is a chef in Nashville who runs a restaurant called Biscuit Love. They sell, you guessed it, lots of biscuits.
He collects biscuit breaks, these beaten biscuit machines, like some people collect guitars. I mean, he has 8 of them, I think, or maybe more, and makes beaten biscuits professionally at his restaurant. So I want people to make these recipes at home and give it a try and have hands in the dough, but then also go see Carl.
Do you ever feel like you wish you could taste the real thing, that everything you do is a reproduction?
Yes, because, I mean, flour is even made in a different way than it was. And I think true historians would probably be like, oh, you should really include, like, the actual real recipe. Yeah, so of course I wish we could time travel and do it. But it's nice to be able to try and to be able to surround yourself with all that sensory experience as you're learning.
So Jennifer has to settle for the reproduction of the thing she loves. David does not. In fact, as a collector, he can't. He needs the real thing. How can you tell if something that you get is genuine? I mean, is that an issue?
Right. Well, fortunate for me, most of the things I collect, there's not a big enough market to have fraud, you know, reproductions. Like, I collect Tennessee Centennial Exposition memorabilia. How many people would want a reproduction Tennessee Centennial or try to pass it off as a real one? There's not a big enough market for that.
Have you ever been fooled?
No. I really look, you look closely at something, and then if it's online for like an eBay merchant who you don't know, you start asking him a question, you know, as opposed to is it original or whatever, what year was it made? And if they don't really answer that nicely, you just stay away from that.
He says there are some things he wants because they're about Nashville that also overlap with other more popular interests, like memorabilia about this old Nashville brewery called Gerst Beer. Those things are in higher demand because the beer collectors are going after them too.
And then the other thing that you get forgeries of are civil rights things. So all over the internet, you'll see these segregation signs, you know, whites, colored water fountains, and colored seated in the rear signs, and 99.9% of them are fake. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. And some are made to look like they're old and rusted and things like that. But those things are so collectible and almost museum pieces that if you do find something from the Jim Crow segregation days, expect to pay thousands of dollars for those.
Why do you think people want that so much?
It's really, collecting is supply and demand. And most of these things were not kept and they were thrown away and they're really scarce and they're really interesting to people. And they also tell a story. When Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, there was a sanitation strike and the I Am a Man signs that the strikers were wearing were going for about $10,000. A lot of people didn't keep those, so the ones that are out there are really collectible.
But dishonesty is actually not that big of a deal in Bradley's line of work, collecting stories.
My projects have become much more about the way people curate their past. And so that can be full of lies, but they become very interesting lies. You know, for example, one of the first big documentary projects I thought I was doing was the history of this small town radio show in La Follette, Tennessee. And I wanted to know when it started and who played when and who started this group. And all of that became far less interesting than the way that people were reacting to even being asked about it, to the fact that anyone even cared about it. And then would sort of negotiate their position, how big they wanted to make themselves in the story, how small.
So the story became less about the facts and more about small-town politics. The local newspaper ran an article about Bradley's project on this old radio show called the Tennessee Jamboree.
And I got a call from Florida from the son of a man who was absolutely sure that it was all wrong and that his father had started the show and was just incredibly angry. And the more I dug, you figure out it's not really a historical conflict, it's a personal conflict between those two people. The battleground is history.
We've got a good crowd on hand already, and we know it's real early yet. Got plenty of seats for you tonight, plenty of parking room, and we're going to have a real turn down time, my granny, here on the Big Tennessee Jamboree tonight.
And sure, I knew I could triangulate certain facts and figure out who was maybe misremembering or mistelling, but that became much more interesting. So I don't worry that much about people lying to me. I like that. I think that's the performance of history, the performance of memory.
History is messy, no matter what medium you use to retell it. Coming up, we'll talk to David Ewing about Civil War expos and Confederate memorabilia, and Jennifer Justice talks about how Beyoncé used food to start a conversation about race. Stay with us.
This episode of Movers and Thinkers is sponsored by Strategic Hospitality, creators of watering holes like the Patterson House, a speakeasy-style bar that brings back cocktails from the past. Beverage director Matt Toko mixes up a classic recipe from the 1800s.
So, we're going to make a rye whiskey old-fashioned. First thing we use is a quarter ounce of Demerara syrup. And next, we'll use 2 ounces of rye whiskey. Angostura bitters, cinnamon, clove, nutmeg. We're going to strain the cocktail, peel some citrus, we zest it on top, and then we insert it.
Now I get to try it?
Yes. Cheers.
Oh.
When cocktails got fancier, with fruity mixers and liqueurs, traditionalists would order a drink the old-fashioned way. Spirit, sugar, bitters, and water. Nothing else. A history lesson in a glass, courtesy of Strategic Hospitality. This episode is also sponsored by Case Antiques, Auctions, and Appraisals. It's a total thrill to hold a piece of history in your hands. This is what Sarah Campbell Drury at Case Antiques does every day.
Okay, this is a book written in 1890. It's a biography of Abraham Lincoln, so kind of cool, right? Good-looking book. What's really special inside? This is a presidential pardon signed by Abraham Lincoln.
Wow.
You want to touch something Abraham Lincoln touched?
Yes.
Besides selling things that Abraham Lincoln touched, Case Antiques also has a bronze Tibetan figurine and a brass compass used to survey Nashville in the 1700s. You can invest in the past at Case Antiques' upcoming auctions. Browse and bid online at caseantiques.com.
We're talking to documentarian Bradley Hansen, collector David Ewing, and food writer Jennifer Justice about preserving history, or rather, making history relevant to modern audiences. Take this one recipe in Jennifer's cookbook, Nashville Eats. It's a play on hot chicken, this spicy fried chicken dish made popular decades ago in a primarily African-American part of town. But the book has a recipe from a ramen restaurant in Nashville. Like, I'm thinking specifically of the Japanese-influenced hot chicken buns.
Yeah.
If something is so far removed from the source, does it still hold value?
Oh, goodness. The Fraternal Order of the Hot Chicken, the Facebook group, would probably have a field day with the, and maybe already has, with the hot chicken buns. But I wanted to show a different interpretation of hot chicken and have an original, a more original hot chicken recipe also. So is that hot chicken? I don't know, but it's a riff on it, I guess.
One thing that strikes me about food is, like, people can really tend to romanticize it. People can just write love stories to their family's food history. I'm wondering, does food gloss over the difficult parts of history, like conflict and inequality? Like, can you have those conversations when you start with food?
I think you can definitely have those conversations, and that's some of the best food writing and best food stories. When food is a lens through which to talk about the harder stuff of race and religion, and it doesn't necessarily make the conversation easier, but it at least makes the conversation maybe happen, because you can go from, oh, this is how you make your bread, to, oh, and this is how you do your religion. There's a podcast called Sporkful that's been doing a series on other people's food. They're talking about appropriating, like a white person cooking a traditionally black food, like Gullah cuisine in South Carolina. This was a big to-do all over the internet.
Another example, look at Beyoncé's song Formation. It inspired all these think pieces about food and race.
And just the line about hot sauce in my bag.
I got hot sauce in my bag.
Obviously, this wasn't just about how hot Beyoncé might like her food, but it's a cultural connection to her background. So, yeah, those are really the best food stories, in my opinion.
David, there's obviously no shortage of objects that spark controversy, and I'm wondering if you could talk about how you approach those, and I'm thinking specifically of Confederate flags.
There's a Civil War show the first weekend in December down at the Franklin Ag Expo. It's the largest Civil War show in the world, and you go down there, there's uniforms and guns and belt buckles and Confederate flags. I mean, I don't collect Confederate flags, but, you know, if it's authentic to the era and it was part of the Civil War, obviously that's a collectible. The only Confederate flag thing I've collected over the years, there was a little badge from the Tennessee Centennial Exposition. The Confederate Veterans Reunion came there. I have one little badge from that.
Did you make a conscious decision to not collect Confederate memorabilia?
It's just not in the wheelhouse of what I collect. I don't collect Civil War memorabilia on either side. I collect things related to the Tennessee Centennial, the Ryman Auditorium, the Opry, and just Nashville businesses in general.
I want to delve a little bit more into, like, how to deal with problematic history. Bradley, for example, do you ever get people who are inadvertently saying things that in this day and age sound racist or sexist, and how do you decide whether to include that in their final document?
Well, I think in my work, the sort of music scene in Appalachia, historically, a tremendous amount of sexism just ingrained. For example, still today, some people call female vocalists in country music girl singers. And this is a term that was ubiquitous in that world. And I went through a time where I was reuniting musicians who had played together on this radio show I was mentioning earlier, the Tennessee Jamboree, reuniting them in 2007 or 8 versus 1967. And in a festival that had a very different set of values than their show did 50 years earlier in terms of the place of the girl singers. And the men had trouble with that. They didn't value the place of women in the music scene, some men. And it was a great conflict. But what can you do? I mean, we made sure that these women were able to sing and participate and claim their place in the history of this show. As a values change, you have to make slight adjustments and hope that the people go along with you and give you the authority to do that.
If you don't want me, baby, if you're not satisfied, if you don't care, get on your horse and ride, ride, ride.
Bradley brings up an interesting point about gender in history. Women often are missing from history books, either because they just weren't in public roles as much or because their roles were diminished. But that doesn't seem to be an issue in Jennifer's work. Like, she has this project called Dirty Pages, which is not what it sounds like, right? Can you explain what that is?
So it's about, you know, the dirtiest recipe in your cookbook that has the smudge of chocolate and a stain of wine probably has the best story. So we did an exhibit with women and their dirtiest pages and the story behind the page to sort of bring that to life.
But Jennifer says in most of her work, she doesn't intentionally write about women.
I like to try to tell the story of the restaurant or the person on the fringe. And so it just happened to be women because they aren't, you know, in the forefront as often. But I didn't intend for it to be that way. In Dirty Pages, we did. We did want it to be all women just because that project is more about home cooking. And we wanted to celebrate the home cooks that aren't in the limelight.
One thing I wonder with all of these people preserving history is how do you decide what to preserve? I mean, with Jennifer's cookbook, for example, future generations might see that and think that is the definitive guide to Nashville food for 2016. Do you feel a sense of responsibility to get outside of your own interests because otherwise it'll just be your history?
I did worry a lot about that, and I started research at the Nashville room of the downtown library and just pulled out every community cookbook, every book that I could find that was written about Nashville, and started with a long list of what to include. And then I had to fight for some that I think either Beaten Biscuits or Spice Round, the editor in New York who had never been to Nashville, you know, wanted to just cross it right out, and I kind of had to be like, no, we have to lose this other thing and not that.
As a collector, I consider myself the curator for some future institution.
Here's David again.
I want everything that I have basically to be in some university or a library or a museum, so future generations will be able to look at it, study it, and it'll be properly kept. As someone that goes to all these yard sales and flea markets and auctions, you always wonder, how in the world did the family let this out of their collection?
Can we do a little show and tell?
Yes.
You brought some stuff from your own family.
When I went to law school and graduated in 1992, I thought I was the first lawyer in my family. Well, great. And then I went to a family reunion, met all these cousins I really didn't grow up with because my father died at a very early age. And my great-great-grandfather's house, Prince Albert Ewing, was still standing. And little did I know, he was the first African-American lawyer in Nashville. So I wasn't the first lawyer in my family. I wasn't the second either, because his twin brother was also a lawyer here. Had I looked at certain books in Vanderbilt Law School, I would have seen cases that they worked on. When I went out to family reunion, I saw this house. It reminded me of an episode of American Pickers. There was just stuff all over the place. And this is my great-great-grandfather Prince Albert's law license, his license to practice law from 1873.
He holds up a yellowing piece of paper protected under lamination. It's written out in cursive, looks very official. Then he holds up a smaller piece of paper.
This is a poll tax card from Nashville, Tennessee from 1880 that belonged to my great-great-grandfather. $2, which is about the equivalent of $50 today, to vote here in Nashville. The item that I'm most proud of that I think is most significant, this is a voter registration card. Now, I dare anyone to even probably find their voter registration card from 20 years ago. This is from 1920. It belonged to my great-great-grandmother, Isabella Ewing, who was married to Prince Albert. On August 18, 1920, we ratified the 19th Amendment. 27 million women got the right to vote, including African-American women, including my great-great-grandmother, who voted in that first presidential election. You think, oh, all these women got to vote. But here it says, you know, this is to certify that Isabel Ewing of the 4th District in Davidson County is duly registered on this 12th day of October 1920 to vote. And so here it is.
So how do we know what to keep? I mean, there are so many stories that we could document in our own families and so many recipes that we could keep and so many items. Like, what is worth keeping? What do you guys keep of your own family stuff?
Oh, I keep everything. When I first started doing oral history work, I was working for the Tennessee State Parks. They hired people to go out and do field work related to land use and culture. During my job interview, my future boss explained to me that this was a triage operation, that we would have to make choices about who we were going to talk to today. And that choice meant that we were not going to talk to this other person, maybe ever. If you can get a hold of somebody and they want to talk to you, somebody else might not have been by the phone and you might not get another chance to do an interview with them, and then their stories might not get recorded. And that's especially difficult when you're talking about people. There will be things that just pass along.
David, with things, like, do you keep random papers in hopes that your grandkids will find them useful one day?
Surprisingly, I don't keep as many things from me than I do from my ancestors or somebody from 100 years ago, 150 years ago, because there's only so much space. And so the things that are around today, I don't consider scarce. So I would rather keep those letters from the 19th century or those interesting items from that era, particularly the Reconstruction period and African Americans and Jim Crow. There's just not a lot of that around.
Is there sort of a holy grail item or person that you would just love to find?
I think I'd like to see the original Loveless Cafe biscuit recipe.
Jennifer is talking about a roadside restaurant on the outskirts of Nashville, famous for its southern cooking, including, of course, biscuits.
And it maybe doesn't even exist in paper form, but I'd like to know what that original recipe was, because I don't think it's the same as it is today.
I collect things related to the women's suffrage movement in Nashville, and we had the first women's suffrage parade in 1914, and that same year in the fall, the national organization had their national convention at the Ryman Auditorium. I cannot find one picture or image or program or button or ribbon from that convention or that parade. I've been collecting for 25 years, still looking.
Well, I'll tie this into food and Nashville. I worked with another group of musicians named the Pinnacle Mountain Boys, and in 1962, they won a Pet Milk song contest to play on the Grand Ole Opry, and they were paid to come travel here, and they played on the Friday Night Opry.
Not as popular.
not as popular, but believe me, this was the highlight of their career. I believe a recording of that night exists, and I haven't been able to get it, but I would love to have it for myself. But to share with them that are alive and remember that night and have probably not heard the recording ever.
Well, Bradley, David, Jennifer, thank you so much for being here. It's a fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Emily. Yeah.
That's Jennifer Justice, David Ewing, and Bradley Hansen, guardians of the past. Movers and Thinkers is produced by Nashville Public Radio. We have photos and liner notes from this episode, links to things that we mentioned, on WPLN.org/movers. And if you want to attend the next live conversation, you can sign up for our mailing list there. And check out our other podcasts. Neighbors is a show about what connects us, and Curious Nashville is where we answer your questions about the city. The upcoming episode is going underground, literally, into the tunnels of Nashville, and we found some crazy stuff.
You see the tunnel? There is a tunnel.
There's a tunnel this way?
Yeah.
But it looks like there's a tunnel on the other side of this wall.
Yeah.
That episode is coming soon. You heard it here first. You can find more at podcasts.wpln.org. The engineers for this episode are Carl Peterson and Cameron Adkins. Editors are Mac Linebaugh, Blake Farmer, Anita Bug. Music by Blue Dot Sessions and by Dave Coleman and Justin Shipper. I'm Emily Siner, and this is Nashville Public Radio.